Welcome back to Asia Pacific Perspective. I'm your co-host James Corbett of CorbettReport.com.
And I'm Brock West from APPerspective.net. James, our first episode of the Asia Pacific Perspective for 2015. And as always, let's roll up our sleeves and hit the ground running. We'll take our first story from ChannelNewsAsia.com with the headline reading, Malaysia PM under scrutiny over wealth and opposition crackdown. Malaysia's premier is under mounting scrutiny for cracking down on opponents, troubles in a strategic development fund, and questions over his family's assets, with even ruling party conservatives questioning his leadership. Prime Minister Najib Razak took the helm of the multi-ethnic country's long-ruling regime in 2009, promising to soothe racial tensions and bolster democracy. But he is under fire from progressives for abandoning such pledges and from ruling party hardliners over his involvement in 1MDB, a development vehicle he launched that is believed to be in a precarious state. Quote, people are beginning to doubt whether he is in is he the sort of leader who can address Malaysia's problems, said Wan Saiful Wan Jan, the head of Malaysia's think tank Ideas. Malaysia also drew international criticism after opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim was jailed for 5 years last week on a sodomy conviction widely considered politically motivated, the latest in a crackdown on Najib's opponents. IMDB, meanwhile, has missed repeated deadlines to pay down billions of dollars in debts, according to Malaysian media reports, with questions swirling around the whereabouts of huge sums. 1MDB said a $560 million loan payment was finally made last week after a Malaysian billionaire was reportedly drafted in to stump up the cash. Also last week, a New York Times investigative report detailed multi-million dollar purchases of luxury US real estate by a close Najib family associate, financier Lo Taek Joel, whom various reports have linked to 1MDB. It also said documents showed millions of dollars in jewelry purchases by Rosmar Mansour, Najib's wife, who was widely ridiculed in Malaysia for her luxurious tastes. Continuing on here, but Malaysia's opposition and other government critics who allege decades of widespread government graft have called for Najib to detail the sources of his wealth and for an independent audit into 1MDB. The government is yet to respond with such calls. Fears that the fund could collapse and rattle Malaysia's financial system have exacerbated economic unease in their energy-exporting country. James, there are many, many intriguing layers to this story, and it's going to be interesting to see how and where the chips land in the Malaysian political landscape in the near future. But it must be so convenient as a sociopathic elitist leader to have these secret offshore bank accounts and billionaire buddies to help cover up and bail you out of any precarious position that you put yourself in. So what's your take on this story? And as we were talking about just before we started recording, there are many, many different players and layers swirling around Malaysia right now. And apart from the obvious conflict of interest with this 1MDB company that the Prime Minister is the chief chairman of, I can only imagine the other type of under the table deals that were struck once this apparent billionaire bailout went ahead.
Well, you're right. I mean, I think at layer after layer after layer is the way to look at this story. And I know that a lot of people want to look at anything surrounding Malaysia in a very narrow lens. Given the events of last year and the Malaysia Airlines crisis, I got a lot of people contacting me basically saying, well, this looks like Malaysia is being targeted by the New World Order or whoever because of their participation in such things as the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal that has sentenced Bush and Cheney and others for war crimes and those types of things, in absentia, of course. That is certainly one of the aspects of what's swirling around in Malaysian politics these days, but I wouldn't say it's the predominant one. And that is related to the former prime minister of the country, Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, who was part of the Perdana Peace Organization that, for example, hosted the 9/11 Revisited conference that I spoke at in Kuala Lumpur a couple of years ago. And he is also affiliated with the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Commission. But He has been in the past a backer of the current prime minister, the one who's now caught up in this scandal, but he withdrew his support last year, and it's not the first time that he's really kind of worked behind the scenes to appoint a successor to him as prime minister and then withdraw his support later on. So there's lots of jockeying in that sense. And then we have this extra layer, which is just a crazy one, of the former deputy prime minister of the country, the leader of the opposition, has just been jailed for 5 years for sodomy under this ridiculous, archaic British colonial law, and only 7 people have ever been tried under it in the last 75 years, one of them being the former deputy prime minister of the country. This is, I mean, to say that this is not in any way politically motivated, I think is disingenuous at best. But then you look at this opposition leader, this Anwar Ibrahim, and he is a globalist through and through. In fact, was the former chairman of the Development Committee of the IMF and World Bank, or something along those lines. Yes, chairman of the Development Committee of the IMF and the World Bank, and he meets with William Cohen in the Pentagon and other such things. He's absolutely part of the globalist network and connected with things like that spontaneous opposition uprising we saw in 2011, Bursi 2.0, which turned out to be funded by George Soros, surprise, surprise. So I'll throw in a bunch of links detailing some of this and saying that basically this is not a simple thing. There is no black and white. There's no good person or clean hand in all of this. This is just a lot of internal Malaysian politics and jockeying for position and the future of the country that's going on right now. And yes, I mean, I have no doubt that this Najib Razak is up to his eyeballs in all sorts of shady dealings and offshore bank accounts and all sorts of things, just like most of these political crooks are. The real interesting part of this is that it's being exposed now, and it's being exposed by Human Rights Watch and in CNN op-eds and things like this, which clearly show that there is some sort of maneuver going on right now to try to get Najib Razak out of power in some form. But to whose benefit and in what way and in what end, I think there's a multiplicity of different levels to this story. So hopefully in the future I can get on some of my Malaysian contacts to talk in more depth about what's going on in the country, because I think it's not black and white. It's not so simple, but clearly there are some major moves that are taking place on the chessboard right now, and it will be in some way decisive for the future of Malaysia. So I think people should keep their eye on what's happening there politically right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Noel Bowie would be particularly one gentleman to speak to, who's always got his finger on the pulse in Malaysia, seeing as he lived there. I haven't spoken to him for a little while, but he would definitely be good to get his opinion on the current situation in Malaysia. Moving on, James, and just quickly in some other political crony crook elitist updates from around the Asia Pacific. Here in Australia, the Prime Minister Abbott defends his choice to knight Prince Philip amid huge public backlash. This is, of course, the same Prince Philip who wishes to be reincarnated as a deadly virus to help deal with that pesky overpopulation program. And finally, in this first segment, James, in a classic case of problem, reaction, solution, Japanese government examines establishing intelligence agencies just like the CIA. This coming, of course, in the wake of the execution of 2 Japanese citizens by the Islamic State, which the Prime Minister Abe knew about months beforehand and did nothing. Okay, so with that said, we will move on to our second story, James, and this one coming from thevoiceofamericanews.com. Turning one in Vietnam, McDonald's sees mixed performance in Asia. McDonald's marked its first birthday in Vietnam with a 4th restaurant earlier this month, reflecting a mixed year in Asia, even as the company struggles to compete at home in the United States. When the golden arches rose over Vietnam for the first time last year, there was an international buzz for the new, long-awaited market, but the excitement was tempered by cultural and demographic challenges. Could consumers afford a value meal that cost as much as 4 bowls of pho? Would Vietnamese tastes give way to beef patties and fries? Sean Ngo, CEO of VF Franchise Consulting, said companies focus on emerging countries like Vietnam as a strategy to counterbalance weak sales in industrialized countries. Many fast food restaurant chains have been developing markets in Asia for the past 2 decades as a means of future growth for the brands in the US, said Ngo. Last summer, the Big Mac maker suffered a tainted meat scandal that hit Japan and China, however, which plunged its Asia Pacific, Middle East, and Africa profits by 55%. When asked if that affected consumers in Vietnam, marketing manager Thai Nguyen said, "A little bit." Growth in the Southeast Asian country is part of an expansion plans across emerging markets. McDonald's said in 2013 in its annual report that it plans to open 800 restaurants in Asia, Africa, and in the Middle East, compared with 300 in Europe and 250 in the US. We should expect that rising consumerism of Western and specifically American products in Asia will continue for decades to come, Ngo said, and will provide a counterbalance, as that word again, to likely declining sales in mature markets such as the United States. So, James, the first thing that I want to point out with this particular article is those phrases, counterbalance and emerging countries, that are mentioned a couple of times. And where have we heard these words before? Ah, that's right. Ever since the so-called Asia-Pacific pivot was announced and proclaimed from every mountaintop by the Obama administration a few years ago, it's striking to me how similar the language used by military and politicians is to that of giant multinationals. It's almost like they're one and the same. I'm not really sure. It's not really surprising, but it does point to the many shapes, sizes, and forms that these dangerous globalization agendas can take to infiltrate countries and to lay down roots virtually anywhere across the globe now. So it doesn't always have to come via the barrel of a gun, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So having said that, though, this is a positive in the sense that not every Vietnamese person is flocking through the golden arches to shovel that crap into their mouths in at least the numbers that the McDonald's R&D department predicted that they would. Actually, some close friends of mine lived in Vietnam for a few years, and one of the many things that they enjoyed about living there was that in virtually every neighborhood and every town, it had its own local market selling its own local produce. The idea of sourcing your own locally grown food is by far and away more entrenched in the Vietnamese psyche than a Big Mac ever could hope to be. So as we will talk about in our final segment today, James, these solutions to these issues start in each of our own communities. By doing it ourselves and not buying in, literally in this case, to the multinationals' dream of a McDonald's or a KFC or whatever crap that they want on every street corner across the globe.
I think you're right. I think you hit the nail on the head that basically this is just a different branch of the same drive that we see the U.S. military, you know, with a barrel of a gun forcing U.S. Will on different countries. Well, this is just a different branch of that same tree. And this is the cultural hegemony rather than the military hegemony. And for decades, it's been devastatingly effective. I mean, we all hear the stories of when the first McDonald's opened in Moscow or whatever, and people lined up, you know, for miles to try to get in. And this has been repeated in country after country and culture after culture. But I think you're right. This is a sign that things are falling apart for that agenda. Because if you read this article from CIA News, I mean VOA News, I always get those confused. It sounds like a press release for McDonald's, perhaps unsurprisingly. It's a mixture in Asia, and they're trying to expand, and there's been some setbacks. No. If you read between the lines, it's been a dismal failure in Vietnam so far, and people are not flocking to it like they have in other countries and other times. And I think this is not just specific to Vietnam. I think this is part of a wider phenomenon that's going on that we can see in the plummeting sales of McDonald's. McDonald's having a particularly bad year for sales last year, due to a number of factors, but including those tainted meat scandals and other scandals that have popped up here in Japan. And I can attest to this personally, thankfully. Yesterday I was downtown and I was going by the new McDonald's in the new shopping mall here in my town. And it was great. There was a McDonald's right across from a Japanese cafe chain, still a chain store, but at least a Japanese cafe. And it was right during the peak time when most people are going to get their morning coffee or whatever. McDonald's almost completely empty. The Japanese chain lined up people trying to get there. People are abandoning McDonald's here, and I think that's a great thing, and I hope that that trend continues, and hopefully that will spread to abandoning the big chains altogether and going toward more independent shops. But I think the cultural hegemony of America is breaking down, and we see that not only with McDonald's and KFC and whatever else. We also see that on the technology front. The latest NSA backdoor revelations from Kaspersky in Moscow, showing, once again, surprise, surprise, yeah, all of this hardware and software that's coming out of these U.S. tech firms is infected. This is going to lead to more and more people basically buying from other sources, non-U.S. tech firms. It's a cultural hegemony that's breaking, and a business hegemony that's breaking down on every level right now. And I think that's for the good. It's not going to be for the good for a lot of American workers, unfortunately, but those workers will find, hopefully, ways to get out of the corporate treadmill and onto the into the independent and alternative economies that we're hoping to build up anyway as the real solution to all of this. So some big moves are taking place, and I think this story in Vietnam is a good window into that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just when you were mentioning the in Japan and seeing the McDonald's empty there, I experienced very similar things during my time there over the last few years. And, you know, I can guarantee you, I've never been into a McDonald's, but every time I walk past one, it was, you know, scattered with a couple of people. And but then the ramen noodle shop just down the road was always busy and always had a lineup. So take that for what you will, but that is positive signs that at the very least that people, you know, do see McDonald's for what it is. It's basically just, you know, mass-produced crap that is really, really unhealthy for you. So, yeah, positive signs, and hopefully we can we'll continue to see those signs into this new year of 2015.
I hope so. What's up for number three?
Number three, James, wanted to shine a bit of a light, a bit of a selfish choice on my part this month, but on my own Community Garden Journal, I've just posted just before we hit the record button today, posted week 7 of my journal, First Fruits, it's called. And yeah, basically, I've just been over the last 2 months or so documenting my experiences of signing up and volunteering at my local community garden, which is only a few minutes walk from my place here. And first of all, my own personal experience with it has been so overwhelming and so unexpectedly positive that I really wasn't expecting it. Obviously, just how much I've kind of grown to love it, and how much I care for my little plot, and how much kind of positivity it's brought into my own life by doing such a simple thing as going down, volunteering, meeting some people and getting my hands dirty and, you know, taking the first baby steps to reclaiming my own food independence and food sovereignty. And that already in these few couple of months has expanded into other aspects of my life, where my wife and I now only source from, you know, local organic butchers, which don't use any hormones or anything like that. And, you know, obviously my plot isn't up to the standard of being able to provide daily meals for us yet. It's getting there, but you know, that has also led us to go and, you know, source our produce solely and wholly from the farmers market, you know. So that was a bit of a change, but a massively positive one that I just can't imagine that I've procrastinated on for so many years. So yeah, this has been a really wonderful experience, and not just that, but also the overwhelming positive response that I've received. And that's thanks in no small part to both yourself and, of course, James and Pilato for your honourable mentions in New World Next Week over the last few weeks. So, yeah, it's just been wonderful, and I hope at the very least it encourages a lot of you out there to go out, find your own little plot of land, join a local community garden, and just get your hands dirty. It's really not that difficult at all.
Well, I mean, that's such an important point. We can spend our time worrying about and trying to scrutinize to the nth degree all of these geopolitical machinations and things of this sort, or we can be in the garden actually taking some of these matters into our own hands directly. And I mean, I think diverting a little more of our energy away from just watching these reports about countries that we've never been to or will never visit, and going towards things that are actually happening in our back garden, literally, is probably more important. But just tell us about the community aspect of this, because I'm assuming that as a community garden, you've had a chance to meet and interact with some new people as a result of this. What's that community atmosphere like?
It's fantastic. I mean, the first time I went there, there was the local curator. His name is Mark, very lovely chap, welcomed me in with open arms. And then the next time I went down there, I met Marina, who, for those who have been keeping up with the journal, should be familiar with by now. She's our local gardening guru. She's a budding horticulturalist, and she's a walking, talking encyclopedia of all things plants and soil micro biodiversity and all this. And she has just thrown all this knowledge my way, and it's been fantastic. You know, it's a little bit overwhelming at times, I've got to say, but it's just fantastic. And she's so switched on. And then a couple of weekends ago, they put on a local working bee. So unfortunately, it was a bit of a small turnout. There's only about half a dozen of us that showed up. But in any case, it was still good to get in there. You know, we all had a good laugh and cleaned up and did some weeding and did some composting and other things like that, and prettied up the gardens a little bit. So, you know, there is a small community. There is a small community aspect there, and it can only grow from there, you know. So everyone has their own little plots, but we also do help each other out in ways. You know, if you do go down to the plot, down to the garden, and you see your plot is in need of water, you water it. You know what I mean? It's a kind of simple thing. And a lot of people think that there will be theft and, you know, people stealing stuff, but there's really none of that. You know, it's not that kind of environment. It doesn't harbour and foster that kind of environment. So, as I said just before, it's 100% been solely a positive experience for me, and it has introduced me to some wonderful people in this local community that I live in. It's great.
Awesome. Well, as people know, I'm going to start doing my own gardening here this year. Probably a lot less impressive than yours, but it's a start. And hey, next time you come visit me in Japan, you can give me some tips with your newly found green thumbs. So once again, my hat's off to you for doing this and for keeping us up to date with it, because I think it is important to put this out there as that example for other people who may be thinking about this or sitting on the fence. It is something that we can do. It's something we can take into our own hands. So awesome. Great to hear that it's working out for you, and I'm looking forward to more updates in the future. And I think that's going to do it for this edition of Asia Pacific Perspective. Once again, I hope people will follow APPerspective.net for all the latest news and information coming out of this region, increasingly important region of the globe, and increasingly exciting with all sorts of things happening here. And that may not be a good thing all the time, but at least it's a thing. So thank you once again for keeping your eye on all of this, and thanks for the updates.
Thank you so much, James. I'm looking forward to next month. I'll talk to you then.